In the first hour this morning, I thought it would be useful just to talk about John Bunyan himself and remind ourselves of something of who he was and the extraordinary gifts that he had and the accomplishments that he was enabled to do in the Lord. And in the second hour, I want to talk about Pilgrim's Progress, part one. And obviously I can't do that in an hour, you understand. But I'm going to focus on a couple of issues in Pilgrim's Progress from a theological point of view. And in the third session, I want to talk a little bit about Pilgrim's Progress, part two, which nobody seems to have read, which is very sad because I actually think there are aspects of part two that are better than part one. There are aspects maybe that are not, but it has distressingly received poor reviews over the centuries, and I'm not altogether clear in my mind why that is the case. Some of the most wonderful descriptions and characters are actually found in part two of Pilgrim's Progress. And if this helps, and it may not help with half of you, part two is a woman's story and a family story, whereas I think part one is an individual's story and a man's story. And I think the perspective is quite different in part two, and partly because Bunyan is out of prison and now pastoring a church where there are women. And I think it's a much more rounded picture that we have in part two. And from a Reformed point of view, and we are at a Reformed seminary this morning, and this is a Reformation society, so, and Bunyan was a Calvinist, if you didn't realize, so if that offends you, you can leave now. I think from that perspective, there are, in fact, more wholesome truths in part two than there are in part one. I don't mean to be critical of part one, but I'm trying to make a case for part two of Pilgrim's Progress. I have on a number of occasions spoken on both part one and part two, preached a series of sermons on both of them, and they're available on the web somewhere, at First Pres in Jackson, and I've no idea what the website is. Try fpcjackson.org. I think that'll get you there somewhere. But then finding your way to these sermons, that won't take me too long to explain. But and I've done it in about 12 sermons on each book one and book two. My plan, and you are guinea pigs, and I'm experimenting on you this morning to some extent, which is why I agreed to do this. My plan is that next year, the seminary, the other Reformed seminary, grants us sabbaticals every 7 years, and next year is my turn for a sabbatical, and I plan to write something on Bunyan, at least that's my goal, in a series of biographical volumes that Crossway are publishing. So this is a bit of an experiment this morning. And one more thing that I want to say, I've brought with me, I have multiple copies of Pilgrim's Progress, too many to bring on a plane without checking in luggage. So I've just actually brought this one with me this morning. It's the one that's most dear to me. It was given to me by my friend, the roommate of my wife. She wasn't my wife then, but it was given to me in 1973 on my 21st birthday. And there's a quotation here from Psalm 128. Blessed is everyone that feareth the Lord and walketh in his ways. From Jane. Now Jane was the most zealous Christian possibly that I've ever met. She was just on fire for Christ, always witnessing to him. She would stop people in the street as we were walking along and hand them tracts and tell them about Christ. It's a long story, and I don't have time to tell it all now, but the week before graduation, her father, who was militantly opposed to evangelical Christianity, told his daughter, Jane, that if she gave up this Christian nonsense, he would buy her this beautiful house. And she did. She came to me and my wife, and we were dating at the time, and several others, and informed us a couple of days before graduation that she was no longer a believer. And she still isn't to this day. She is a worldly woman today. And Bunyan, of course, has many warnings about that. And part of the phenomenal message of Pilgrim's Progress is the need to persevere, and the need to persevere even to the end. I'm wondering if this light actually works.
It does. Yes, it does.
And how do I... There's something here. Great. I've reached the point where I wear bifocal contact lenses, and I hate them. And sometimes I look down on a page and I can't see anything. And it happens more often than I care to admit. But a light certainly helps. Let me tell you something about Bunyan. During his years in England's First Civil War, and we're talking, of course, about the 1640s, and the Civil War ended in 1646. He was not a believer, but he was to come to faith shortly afterwards. Before long, he became the pastor of a small separatist congregation in Bedford. Separated, that is, from a parish-based national church controlled by Parliament, and therefore independent of the state, but also, of course, separatist in the sense of being separated from the world. Living as what was called, if I may borrow a phrase from another author, visible saints. And the idea of being a visible saint in the world, in this world, in this ungodly world. He would give a first-hand description of his ministry in Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. This man made it his business to deliver the people of God from all those false and unsound ways that by nature we are prone to take and make to our souls. He pressed us to take special heed that we look not up any truth upon trust as from this or that or any other man or men, but to say mightily to God that he would convince us of the reality thereof, and set us down therein by his own Spirit in the Holy Word. He was, of course, a Baptist, but he downplayed baptism, seeing it not as a sign and seal of the covenant of grace and the right of entry into the church community and the Lord's table, but simply something which strengthened personal faith. And he warned on his deathbed not to separate fellowship over this matter. For at least 2 years of his life under Cromwell's system of what we might call established independency, he was rector of St. John's Church in Bedford. Now, are you awake this morning? Because I'm not actually talking about Bunyan. I could see furrowed brows on the front row, thinking that I'd made a colossal blunder. Well, of course, I'm not speaking about Bunyan, not just yet. I'm speaking of what we might call Bunyan's minister, Bunyan's pastor, John Gifford. And John Gifford was a remarkable man, had a profound influence on John Bunyan. He is, of course, evangelist in Pilgrim's Progress. The honorable and wise and grave depiction of evangelist and earnest depiction of evangelist that Bunyan gives in part one of Pilgrim's Progress was taken, of course, from his knowledge and respect for John Gifford. John Gifford had fought in the Civil War, England's only Civil War. He'd fought on the Royalist side, on the wrong side, maybe. And after the war, in Bedford, had set up as a physician. He had, like Bunyan, no formal education, and was never ordained in any formal sense, but he had a heart for God and a love for the Bible and a Puritan's knowledge of the Bible. What is it that Spurgeon says about Bunyan? That if you pricked him, his blood would be bibline, that Bible texts would come out of his veins. When Bunyan made himself known to some godly Bedford women and told them he wasn't converted, they told him of the godly Mr. Gifford, who met and discipled Bunyan, and when 2 or 3 years later Bunyan had become sure of his faith, it was Gifford who baptized him in the River Ouse in Bedford. Godly Mr. Gifford then was the model for at least 3 of Bunyan's characters. Evangelist, as I've just mentioned, the man who directed Christian to the wicket gate and reappeared shortly afterwards to chastise him for not heeding his advice and for listening instead to the advice of Mr. Worldly Wiseman, who told him to put his future in the hands of Mr. Legality, evangelist. And then you remember the very grave person in the house of interpreter with the best of books in his hand and the world behind his back, whose portrait Christian saw in the house of interpreter. The very grave person is no doubt Mr. Gifford. And then in part two of Pilgrim's Progress, one of the perhaps most lovable, exquisite characters Bunyan ever conjured up, Mr. Great Heart, in the servant, heroic servant of interpreter, who appears as a guide and as a protector and as a leader to Christiana and her children, and who escorts them through all the way safely through the river of death, and explaining dangers to them and teaching the faith and killing giants along the way. Well, Mr. Greatheart, the very grave person, evangelist, all three of these, I think, are depictions of John Gifford, the minister in Bedford. Gifford died in 1655, not long after Bunyan's conversion, maybe 2 years or so after Bunyan's conversion. And his influence, theological, ecclesiastical, experiential, lived on through Bunyan till the end of his days. I think it's true to say that Bunyan owed more to John Gifford than he did to anyone else in his life. Well, let's think about Bunyan himself. Bunyan was three things. He was, first of all, a Puritan. I said last night that I define a Puritan as someone, at least on the English side, rather than the New England side, I define a Puritan as someone who lives between the age of the Elizabethan settlement, a century before Bunyan, all the way through until the death of Matthew Henry, the commentator, towards the end of the 17th century. So Bunyan finds himself in the tail end of and perhaps the high point of Puritanism, 150 years or so, technically, in the history of England. He was not as well known and well respected as some Puritans. He was not a scholar. He was not Thomas Goodwin. He was not John Owen. He was, and I'll explain the term in a minute, a sectary in the eyes of some. To certain folk, Bunyan belonged to a sect. He was a Baptist, an independent, someone who engaged in ministry without formal ordination. We mightn't bat an eyelid at that today, and perhaps we might, but certainly in the 17th century, he was regarded as a fanatic, unorthodox, and in truth is that Bunyan was none of those things. By Puritan, I mean a commitment to Reformed theology, unapologetic as a Calvinist, a high Calvinist, not a mediating Calvinist, not a low Calvinist, but a high Calvinist, and someone committed to piety. Oh, what did I say last night? All of life regulated by holiness to the Lord, as the book of Leviticus so singularly puts it. And that Reformed theology and that piety wedded together through Bible-based, Christ-exalting, Holy Spirit-oriented devotional discipline. Yes, there do exist, there does exist in the 17th century, political and ecclesiastical and, yes, soteriological differences between certain Puritans. But I think it's fair to say that Puritans shared a common commitment to what I want to call Augustinian godliness, Calvinistic godliness. After 1640, Puritans led the way in Oxford and Cambridge. One thinks, of course, especially here by the 1650s and 1660s of the Vice Chancellor of Oxford University was none other than John Owen himself. So Puritans were in high places of great learning, intellectual giants of the time, and Bunyan was blue collar. Bunyan was working class. Bunyan sided with some of, this is the age of the revolution, we call it in English history, the revolutionary period, the 1640s brought ranters and diggers and levelers and fifth monarchists and so on. You're familiar, I'm sure, with some of these religious quasi Calvinistic sects, perhaps we might call them, that are hugely influential in the 1640s, and some of them more political than religious. Difficult to make the distinction, perhaps, in between religion and politics in the 1640s, but there were movements, anti-monarchy movements, wanting power for the proletariat, for the people. Not surprising that some of the leading communist historians of the 20th century have seen Bunyan as one of their chief heroic figures, as a working class, blue collar, anti-establishment, anti-intellectual in some ways, figure, distorted, of course, as much of that picture is. But you have to be aware that some of the biographies of Bunyan that have emerged, especially from Cambridge, for example, in the 20th century, have that communist, Marxist philosophy of history that lie behind it, seeing seeing Bunyan then as one of their heroes. Bunyan was a Puritan. Bunyan leads the way for what we might see in the 1640s, a movement of lay spirituality and leadership, encouraged, of course, by the Civil War, the Parliamentary Army. Not for Bunyan to fight as John Gifford did in the Royalist forces, Bunyan joined the parliamentary army. He fought on the parliamentary side, anti-establishment, at least in 1644 and 45. That's what it looked like, I think. And Bunyan, who was drafted into the parliamentary army at 16 and 2.5 years later, was disbanded again. His mother had died suddenly. His sister then shortly afterwards had died. And within a month of his sister's death, his father remarried. Now, they did that sort of thing in the 17th century. And they do that sort of thing in the South to this day. It's quite uncanny to me how quickly folk will remarry after the death of their clearly beloved spouse. But it was more than John Bunyan, I think, could take, and I think his relationship at this point with his father was tense, and Bunyan leaves home and joins the army at 16. He was a Puritan. Secondly, he was a very able Puritan. He was a very able Puritan. Yes, he was a tinker. Yes, he had limited education. I think we can exaggerate that maybe a little too much. He did receive a formal education in reading and writing and arithmetic, the three R's, as they're sometimes called. He tells us in Grace Abounding that he stopped before they got to Plato and Aristotle, and I think you sometimes can detect in Bunyan an anti-intellectualism at certain points, despite his prodigious ability. You'll never see Bunyan citing from the great Greek philosophers, or from anyone else, really, for that matter. His library, I think, was fairly minimal, and although he had a small library, I think he was a man who devoured the few books that he had, rather than as so many intellectuals of his time did read exceedingly widely. He went to school then to learn to read and write, but early in his life he becomes an apprentice to his father, becoming a brassier, or a brazier, I'm not sure how you Americans say that word, somebody who makes pots, somebody who makes cooking pots and kitchen pots and pans. And then at 16, as I said, he signed up, possibly lying about his age in order to join the parliamentary forces at 16. But in 30 years, when he is in his reaching his 50s and 60s, Bunyan has written over 60 theological books and doctrinal books and devotional books and allegorical books and controversial books, 2,000 pages in all, 2 million words. Oxford University Press a few years ago produced a lavish edition of the works of John Bunyan, including some works that had not been published in collected writings of Bunyan before, 17 volumes of them. When he preached in Bedford, he drew hundreds. When he preached in London, on one occasion, it drew a congregation of over 3,000. And when John Owen was speaking one day to Charles II, King Charles II, after the Restoration, after the end of England's dabbling with a republic, the decade or so in which England was a republic, and when Cromwell introduced the protectorate at the end of the 1650s, and John Owen fell out with Oliver Cromwell as his chaplain. Owen was one day speaking to Charles II, the king. Imagine that. Imagine the conversation that John Owen, one of the greatest theologians and Puritans ever, could say in a conversation, you know, I was speaking to Charles II the other day, and Charles II chastised him because he was telling the king about having gone in London to hear John Bunyan preach. And of course, this was beneath Charles II. He was a sectary, as far as Charles II was concerned, unordained, uneducated. And John Owen apparently said to the king that he would gladly give up all of his learning if he could preach but one sermon like that tinker, John Bunyan. Well, you may not know, but if it wasn't for John Owen, Pilgrim's Progress would never have been published. It was difficult initially for John Bunyan to find a publisher prepared to venture the expense and capital to publish a book by an uneducated man. And it was John Owen who secured a contract with his own publishers to have Pilgrim's Progress and Holy War published. Well, Pilgrim's Progress, of course, apart from the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress remains today in the English language the best-selling book of all time. It has never been out of print and is published, of course, in almost every area of the world in dozens and dozens and dozens of different languages. Well, he was a Puritan. He was a very able Puritan. But he was a Puritan who suffered. John Geary, a Puritan, in 1646, wrote a little tract called The Character of an Old English Puritan, in which he describes one of the typical features of a Puritan, employing the Latin motto, vincit qui patitur, he who suffers conquers. He who suffers conquers. Bunyan began to preach shortly after his conversion. His conversion, of course, took place in this early part of the 1650s, after being disbanded from the army, and he takes on this apprenticeship as a brazier again, and he is a blasphemer. He describes in one place how violent his language was. Married a young woman, with whom he had in fairly quick succession four children. It's not without reason, of course, that in part two of Pilgrim's Progress, Christiana has four children. And there's no doubt that Bunyan is autobiographical, I think, at that point, once again. This godly woman of sorts brings with her to the marriage two books given to Bunyan by his father-in-law, and they're books on piety, Puritan piety. Bunyan one day is found in Bedford blaspheming, and some ungodly women rebuke him. It was the beginning of a lengthy process. I think it lasts 2 or possibly 3 years when Bunyan is under conviction of sin. He he meets John Gifford, this pastor in Bedford. Eventually comes to an assurance of faith, and shortly afterwards begins to preach. Well, by 1660, the monarchy has been restored. Cromwell's protectorate is over. There are now some restrictions on Puritanism. The Act of Uniformity will be enacted. The 5 Mile Act that forbade Puritans to preach, Puritan ministers to preach within 5 miles of a congregation, a settled congregation, and so on. And in 1660, Bunyan finds himself at the wrong end of the law, because as an unordained man, he is caught preaching and is fined and imprisoned. Initially imprisoned for 3 to 6 months, but it was to last, of course, as you know, for 12 years. He is let out after 6 years and then immediately arrested again and taken back to prison. So in all, it lasts 12 years from 1660 to 1672. In 1647, then, he had been disbanded from the army. In 1653, he was received into Gifford's congregation, so he's converted at that point, and he's 25 years old. In 1659, about a dozen years or so after he had got married, he'd got married shortly after being disbanded from the army. He was 18 or 19 or so when he got married. His wife died, leaving 4 children, one of whom, the firstborn, Mary, was blind, and with whom John Bunyan had an extraordinary relationship of, I think, great and tender affection. She was herself to die during Bunyan's imprisonment, and one can only imagine the pain that that must have caused Bunyan. Bunyan remarried. She went into premature labor and lost the baby. And Bunyan is arrested then a year after that there would be no more children. But this godly woman, extraordinary woman, who raises the four children from his first marriage, speaks on Bunyan's behalf. One notorious incident where she goes, travels to London to speak to the authorities to try and get Bunyan released from prison. It looks as though Bunyan was on occasions allowed out of prison, but he would make shoelaces when he was in prison, which they would sell, and that way he would provide for his wife and children during his imprisonment. Well, in 1660 then, he is imprisoned. He has bouts of deep anxiety and depression. One Christian psychologist refers, and a Calvinist to boot, refers to it as obsessional disorders. He has diagnosed Bunyan as suffering from obsessional disorders. Why was he imprisoned? Because he refused to comply with orders of Charles II, not to preach at unauthorized, un-Anglican gatherings that in those days were called conventicles. By 1660, he had become Bedfordshire's most well-known and most well-liked preacher, and the king's emissaries wanted to make, I think, an example of him. Well, in 1672, shortly before his release, the Bedford Church called Bunyan to be their minister. Gifford had died, and the congregation was without a pastor, and when he is released in 1672, he becomes their pastor. Now, Bunyan in 1675, 1676, will spend another 6 months in prison. It is my belief, although not all the biographers are consistent here, some say that Pilgrim's Progress, Part 1, was written during that second imprisonment in 1675-76. It appears to me because in Pilgrim's Progress there is a point at which Bunyan seems to describe that things have improved, and that he had laid down his pen and had awoken, and then had gone back to his sleep again and began to dream, and the story begins again. And it seems to me that the evidence is fairly overwhelming that Pilgrim's Progress was actually written in two parts. I don't mean Part 1 and Part 2 of Pilgrim's Progress. I mean, Part 1 was written in two parts. And the first two-thirds of it was probably written toward the latter stages of that first imprisonment, so somewhere between 1670 and 71, perhaps. And then, having been released, he leaves off writing this allegory and then picks it up again during that second six-month imprisonment in the Bedford jail. Well, be that as it may, Pilgrim's Progress is finally published, Part 1, in 1678, a couple of years after his release from that second imprisonment. Part 2 of Pilgrim's Progress, and we'll talk about that in our third session this morning, was published 6 years later in 1684. And next to the Bible, it is the best-selling Christian book of all time. Hundreds of editions and dozens of translations of it existing. What are the main emphases of Pilgrim's Progress? Well, let's hold some of that thunder until the second session. Perhaps this might be a good point to ask if there are any questions on that part of it. Now, remember, we haven't spoken yet about Pilgrim's Progress Part 1 or Part 2 in any detail, but are there any questions on that aspect of John Bunyan's life?
I was thinking of the development of the Reformation in Scotland. Do you comment on any relationship between him and the Scottish Reformers?
The relationship between John Bunyan and the development of the Reformation in Scotland. There would certainly, of course, I think, have been sympathies with the Scots to the parliamentary side of the Civil War, but there was no affinity or warmth between the Scots and Oliver Cromwell. In fact, the Scots were deeply suspicious, and rightly so, of the motivations of Oliver Cromwell. Cromwell, I think, at one point, had a desire, I think, to, especially during the Protectorate period, of enforcing an Englishness upon the Scots. And the Scots were, of course, Presbyterian, with a capital P, and were, whilst they were sympathetic towards the Calvinism of the independents, the 1640s, of course, is the period of the Westminster Assembly, and called in 1643, and we all know what the effects of the Westminster Confession were on England, namely none. It was not acceptable to the English, and therefore, what emerges, of course, under Bunyan, and Bunyan was hugely influential, was the 1689 Baptist Confession, which was published after Bunyan's death. Which is largely the Westminster Confession, except of course the chapter on baptism and also an anti-establishment policy, which they saw in at least the original version of the Westminster Confession in its relationship to church and state. But I dare not speak on any of that in these walls here. You understand the mediatorial kingship of Christ and his reign notwithstanding. Bunyan was, of course, and Pilgrim's Progress was greatly loved by the Presbyterian community in Scotland then and now. I don't think that they had much affinity for Bunyan's ecclesiology so much. I think the Scots, by temperament, warmed to Bunyan's blue-collar, anti-establishment character. And I think you would see that today. I think most Covenanters in Scotland, or say the Free Church of Scotland, Calvinistic folk in Scotland today, tend to be blue-collar, and you'd be appalled, as to how they would vote or who they would support in our forthcoming presidential election. Let me put myself out of the picture here, but most of the Scots, and I mean your brothers, your brother and fellow Calvinists in Scotland, politically would be on an entirely different page then and now, I think. And that concern for, and I know it's an emotive word, but the proletariat, but that concern for the common people, the concern for individual rights, would I think be an aspect that the Scots would I think warm to, but no formal relationship that I'm aware of. Yes.
I get you in hot water if I ask about his dealing with the sacrament.
And it's good to see you. I think I can vaguely focus on who you are, but yes, good to see you.
John Piper has been really influenced by Bunyan in his desire to get to unite Baptists and Presbyterians in his own church.
Yeah, fascinating question.
Could you talk about that from Bunyan's history?
I heard the other day, and I'm sure this isn't true, but I heard the other day that Piper had moved away again, but maybe I'm wrong about that. I'm not right up to date on sort of Baptist politics here. Bunyan, like John Gifford, and I'm absolutely persuaded John Gifford was the influence on John Bunyan here. Bunyan did not believe that baptism should be an issue of separation, of fellowship. And he had a very open view on membership and would not confine that to believers' baptism. Yes, and Bunyan has this broad policy, and I understand that John Piper, at least until I heard something recently, so I'm not absolutely sure where that discussion has gone now, but John Piper has that same policy, and I think it's a policy that has shaped his view through the reading of John Bunyan and others on that issue. I understand, of course, that if you do hold to believers' baptism as the true mode of baptism, and I always want to say that Presbyterians believe in believers' baptism too. It's not an exclusive right of Baptists, because if you haven't been baptized as a child, then you are baptized on profession of faith. So Presbyterians do believe in believers' baptism. But if you believe that is the sole means of baptism, and I think it's a perfectly consistent attitude to hold, that exclude, therefore, participation in the Lord's Supper to those who have not been baptized as believers. I mean, that's a perfectly consistent viewpoint to hold. It just causes a problem for probably many of us in here. I'm not sure what else I can say about it. I rather think that irregularities, as far as baptism is concerned, ought not to be issues that bar us from communion and fellowship with true believers. But there comes a point at which, you know, we do have to exercise a certain discipline in ecclesiology, in an environment where there is no discipline on ecclesiology. And we have our own scruples about certain issues as to who or who may not, say, participate in the Lord's Supper.